Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Start talking. We were talking at tea time today about various and sundry Dhamma issues. Group from San Francisco, Rick Center's group came to visit. Some folks from Berkeley been here still. A few of them still here today. Had a very nice afternoon. Questions and answers discussion. One of the topics that came up as a question was around not self, anatta, or as the question was phrased, as you know, could you please speak some to the Buddha's teachings on no self? Kind of just started at that point with clarifying that perhaps it's a more skillful way to phrase it as the teachings or the trainings around not self rather than no self. But we just kind of unfolded into a discussion around that. And I thought maybe just to continue on with that for a bit this evening. Got issue my disclaimer first here. It's always a little tricky talking about some of these kinds of topics. And I know, you know, sometimes people feel like really shouldn't be broached too much unless you can claim some high states of understanding and attainment, that kind of a thing. But I still find it, even with my limited understanding, I still find it very personally useful for me as a contemplation. And I enjoy thinking about it and talking about it when people ask about it, because the reflections on anatta, not self, I just find very settling, peaceful, useful for me in my practice. So I just want to, you know, mention that it shouldn't be taken what I say as doctrinal truth or anything like that, just reflections of my own that I'm just sharing this evening. The teachings around not self often tend to coalesce around one of the practices of mindfulness or one of the establishments of mindfulness. And you can see that particularly in the fourth satipatthana, the mindfulness of dhammas, certain reflections that the Buddha's said we should establish as a focus for mindfulness training. A series of contemplations, the second of which in that series is contemplation of the five khandhas, or the five aggregates, as we know them, five aggregates of human experience. And the reflections of anatta often focus around those particular five aggregates as a way of an investigation of our experience, a way of developing insight into the path of practice. So any investigation of how we form a sense of self, a sense of identity in the world necessarily will focus around these five aggregates as we do that kind of investigation. And so just to bring, you know, catch people up who may not have a full sense of what that means, the five aggregates, the five khandhas, as they're called, are these five aspects or groups of way we categorize experience of the human life often leads to this sense of solidity or a sense of self. The first being, of course, the aggregate of form, the human body, as a place where we can establish this sense of self, this perception of self. The Buddha often describes these five aggregates in different ways in general, and that actually that this kind of focus or attachment or clinging to any of these five aggregates is what is really the cause of suffering. You hear that in our one part of our morning chanting, the Panchupadanakando, five, what we translate as the five focuses of the grasping mind, or maybe a little more accurately, the five aggregates subject to clinging. So this is what is one of the considered the basic cause of dukkha, is this clinging, sense of clinging, particularly to the sense of self around these five aggregates, but clinging in any way to the five aggregates. And of course, the primary, one of the primary ones is form, this body, and the formation of an identity around it. This body is me or mine or myself. And the Buddha often describes, or in one of his sets of similes, talking about the five aggregates, the Buddha describes this body, or this sense of this sense of a body, how we usually regard it as very solid. But he says, you know, it's consider it similar to a lump of foam that's floating on the Ganges River. Is that, you know, a lump of foam from a distance looks very solid, very substantial. But when you look at it closely, when you investigate it, how substantial really is that lump of foam? It's hollow, void, insubstantial, doesn't really consist much of anything. In the same way, one can regard a form, one can regard the body as like a lump of foam, insubstantial, hollow, empty, void of any intrinsic substance. It doesn't mean that the body doesn't have a sense of solidity or materiality of the elements, you know, earth, water, fire, air. It's all there, and we sense them. But when you investigate the body in a methodical way, you'll start to see that it's mostly just a collection of elements, a collection of parts that kind of blurs together, blends together as an experience of a solid, unchanging entity. But examined closely, piece by piece, that perception starts to break down. And he goes on with the other five khandhas, or with the other four khandhas, the khanda, or the aggregate of feeling, the feelings that come with any kind of contact in the sensory world, any kind of contact through the experiences of sight, sound, taste, touch, sensation, feeling, and mental experience as well. So that there's always this pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality in regard to any contact in the world. So there's this, this is one of the basic mental factors. Feeling comes with every kind of experience that we have through the senses. And he likens this experience to bubbles in a rain puddle. So when the rains come, the monsoons come, and the rain pours, forms puddles on the streets, in the land, and you see the bubbles arise and pop, and then another bubble arise and pop, one after another, after another. Now, this is similar to the nature of feelings, the fleeting nature of these kinds of pleasant, unpleasant feelings. And you can see that in experience, just how, whether it's a physical sensation, how quickly, you know, the body can sense a feeling of discomfort. And then within a flash, a change of position or some change of condition, there's a pleasant feeling instead of the painful feeling, or vice versa. How, you know, like you can be enjoying a good meal, enjoying the pleasant sensations of tasty food, chomping away through something that's really delightful, and all of a sudden bite down hard on something like a shell of a nut and experience cracking a tooth. How quickly that pleasant experience changed to a painful experience. And just seeing the constantly changing nature of that bodily experience and feeling. And similarly in mental conditions, how quickly a pleasant state of mind can change to a painful state of mind just by somebody who walks in the room, somebody who you've had maybe a difficult time with, you're doing just fine, and all of a sudden he or she walks into the room, and all of a sudden the mood changes, and the feeling of unpleasantness arises, or somebody yells at you just when you're in the midst of enjoying something, and the feeling changes from pleasant to painful. Or you're in a really rotten mood, and somebody comes up and offers a very gentle compliment of some sort, something they appreciated, and how quickly that bad mood moves away, and you're, you know, basking in a pleasant experience. So just noticing the experience of feeling, how quickly it changes, moves from one to another, bubbles in a puddle. The changeability of that. Perceptions, these different ways of categorizing, understanding our experience in the world. When input comes in through the sense bases, sights, again, sight, sounds, taste, touch, feelings, and bodily feelings, how we immediately identify them, categorize them, beyond the raw experience. We go back using memory in a flash. All of a sudden, we've identified that visual object out there and name it as a tree or a cloud or whatever it is that we're perceiving at that time. And it becomes something rather than just an experience. solidifies very quickly. And the same with different kinds of mental objects that come in. You know, somebody says something, and we relate it to a past experience that caused us pain or difficulty, and all of a sudden what that person says, what that person represents, becomes a painful perception based on a past experience. And if we're not careful, we jump right onto that perception, solidify it, turn it into something real, and then move to react towards it and react against it and push it away if it's unpleasant, or similarly if it's pleasant, to run after it once we've established it as a pleasurable memory, pleasurable perception. And then the way the Buddha talks about that is perception is like a mirage. How quickly one perception can turn into another. How it really can fool us into thinking that it's something that it isn't. A classic example from some of the teachings is you're walking along the path, and all of a sudden, in front of you, there's this object on the ground, and it's long and it's curved and it's sitting there, and the mind will classify it, jump right on it and think, snake, careful, watch out, there's a snake in the path. And then you get a little bit closer, or you look a little bit more closely, and you see, oh, that wasn't a snake, that's a piece of rope. Well, what happened to the snake? It wasn't ever really there. It was just a misperception. It's the way the mind will automatically leap on a set of characteristics and identify it in some way. How quickly that can change. It is just like a mirage. It's not what it appears to be. All of our perceptions can be like that. Not what it appears to be. Again, sort of, as the Buddha describes, hollow, insubstantial. Not anything in and of itself, other than a mental event. Fourth khanda of mental formations. All these other kinds of mental experiences, like thoughts and emotions, moods of the mind. He compares those to if you were taking like a plantain tree and starting from the bark out and unraveling the plantain tree. It's basically a, I guess it's kind of a coil as I understand it, that you can constantly peel, or more like an onion in a way, you know, where there's these layers upon layer, and you keep digging and pulling off more and more layers, looking for the substantial core, looking for the heartwood of the plantain tree, looking for something solid and unchanging from which all these, in the analogy where all these mental formations are arising from, or what they represent, a solid core of experience in the mental world. And like a plantain tree, you can keep on unraveling all of these experiences, delving back and investigating where did they come from, what's its origin, and you get to the center and there's nothing there. There's no solid core, nothing substantial that you can point to say, you know, this is my unchanging, these are unchanging events of the mind, this is a solid core of mental activity. They're just one layer after another that have arisen through causes and conditions. Nothing solid or substantial in the middle there. And the fifth aggregate, consciousness, vijnana, discriminative consciousness, he compares to a magician's illusion, in that consciousness keeps on trying to weave this sense of reality, to try and present a coherent experience of continuity in a human life, so that consciousness, the basic ground or quality of awareness that keeps on moving from one sense base to another. So one moment visual consciousness is alive and active and apprehending the visual world, the world of objects outside of us. And in the next split second, the hearing consciousness is activated, taking into awareness the aspect of sound or objects that the ear sound perceives, moving very quickly through all of the six sense bases, smells and tastes and physical tactile sensations and objects of the mind. This constant moving back and forth from one to another, weaving this sense of continuity like a movie, blending all together into one seemingly seamless sense of experience, creating the illusion of something real and substantial. But like a magician's trick, it's an illusion. Broken down, or when the magic stops, then the illusion breaks down. When the mind, if the mind can go slow enough to stop piecing together all of this in a coherent way, then experience starts to lose its sense of continuity. And you can see that sometimes, get little hints of it anyway, when say you're falling asleep or dreaming and things aren't quite so coherent and consciousness isn't quite so organized and it's a different state of mind and all sorts of, or if the you know, the mental faculties start to erode out of illness, mental illness in some way, or deterioration of certain brain functions, that you know, sort of a sense of cohesion can start to melt away. And it's not that consciousness in itself is you know, stopping to function, stopping its functioning, but that it's altered in a way that gives one a sense of its that it's all very fragile, that it's all very much dependent on a very specific set of circumstances to keep it all going, otherwise it breaks down. So this is, you know, the Buddha's very skillful way of describing these five aggregates, and that we can view them as ultimately not something that is so substantial or solid that we can pin a sense of self onto. One of the aspects of consciousness that I've also found a very nice description, just to kind of show the relentlessness of this process of creating an experience to identify with as self, is also the Buddha talks about consciousness as one of the four nutriments, and in his description, the four nutriments being certain aspects of experience that contribute and lead one to this ongoing state of being or becoming or identity, establishing a sense of belongingness or becoming in the world, a sense of identification, that there are nutriments to that process. And one of those nutriments is consciousness itself. And he has a very graphic simile to describe how that works with, he says, well, suppose there was a criminal, and the criminal is brought before the king, and the king orders his workers to punish this criminal by taking him off and stabbing him with 100 spears in the morning. And so they go do that, and they inflict this punishment on the criminal, stab him with 100 spears, and then come back to the king to report on the situation. The king says, well, what happened? Is he still alive? And the workers report, yes, yeah, he stabbed 100 times, he's still alive. So the king orders him to go back, noontime, stab him with another 100 spears. And they come back again and report that yet again the criminal is still alive. He hasn't succumbed to this punishment. So the king orders him to go back again in the evening, stab him with another 100 spears. They come back once more and report, he's still alive, he hasn't given up, he hasn't died. And so the Buddha says, you know, so too, your consciousness is like this, you know, contemplate that consciousness is like this. And it's kind of obscure because he doesn't go any further and explain, well, what does he mean? How is consciousness like being stabbed 3 times with 100 spears, you know, and the pain and difficulty that causes? And so it's kind of left up to our own interpretation. But one way that I kind of have used it as a reflection is to think that this consciousness of ours that constantly moves from one sense base to another to establish this sense of self, this sense of identity, this sense of becoming, is so relentless. And even in the face of so much suffering and so much pain that we can feel and experience in this human condition, that the prospect of letting that go, letting that experience of go, that identification with body and mind, that this constant fleeting consciousness, identification in the of the consciousness with these five aggregates, or with these, with these six sense bases provides, it's too much to try and start letting go of that. That no matter how painful it is, no matter how many times we get stabbed, we are just relentlessly trying to create this sense of identity around something, around anything. We're so desperate to keep this sense of self going, the sense of identity and becoming going, that we'll pretty much endure anything. And consciousness is willing to keep on grasping, to keep on holding to different kinds of experience in this pursuit. So that's how I kind of liken that simile. And he says if you understand this nutriment of consciousness, then you do understand name and form, so that seeing how, name and form is basically the five khandhas is maintained, and how it is supported by this relentlessly moving consciousness. So the idea of the Buddhist teachings on anatta, not self, are structured around how to reflect on or experience these five khandhas in a way through reflection, through consideration, through observation, to lessen this grip of this perception of self, which causes us so much suffering. It was a lovely phrase that, I hope I get this right, when Ajahn Sopa was here from Thailand, I think he phrased it in some way like this, the sense of self is the home. The home or the home base for suffering. The sense of self is the home for suffering. So if we really want to experience the end of suffering, we have to deconstruct this perception of self so that it doesn't reside in this experience of self any longer. There's no place for suffering to settle around this sense of self. And so the Buddhist teachings, insight teachings, push us in this direction. And there's the basic two gateways to understanding anatta will be through the other two, what's called the other two characteristics. There's the three characteristics, anatta. And they're often it's often understood or experienced or penetrated more through reflection or contemplation on the other two, anicca and dukkha, impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. So contemplation of those two helps lead to an understanding or penetration of the concept or the experience, I guess, of not-self. And is exemplified, as many of you know, within the Anattalakkhana Sutta, one of the ones that I find most useful for just contemplation, just thinking about it, reviewing it in my mind. One of the most enjoyable contemplations that I have is just reciting and considering some of those reflections offered in that sutta. Just very plainly and very directly in that with going through the five khandhas and contemplating the five khandhas in relation first to dukkha, first to unsatisfactoriness, with the primary declaration or the preliminary declaration of form is not self. If form were self, then form would not lead to affliction. And one might be able to say of form, let it be like this, let it not be like this. But since form is not self, form therefore will lead to affliction. And one can't rightly say of it, let it be like this, let it not be like this. So essentially what he's pointing to in that is that that we don't have control, that it's unsatisfactory form, body, the bodily experience. We fundamentally don't have much control over it, what happens to it. We can influence it, of course. We take care of it as best we can, but in the end, it's part of nature. We don't have any sense of control that would be implied by being an owner of it or it being who I am. If it were if it were under control, if it were a self that we can control, or we had a self that could control the body, we wouldn't let it become afflicted. We wouldn't invite all of the pains and difficulties that can be experienced in the human body. If we had that kind of control, we'd be able to direct it and say, let it be like this, and let it not be like this. But that's not there. We can just see from our own experience, the illness comes when we don't want it to. Eventually, the body will go its course of nature and pass away, dissolve back into its constituent elements. So it's unsatisfactory. Therefore can't be considered to be who I am or to be under any kind of self-control. Then he goes on to say feeling is not self. If feeling were self, then feeling would not lead to affliction. And one would be able to say in regards to feeling, let it be like this, let it not be like this. But since feeling is not self, it therefore leads to affliction. And one can't rightfully say, let it be like this, let it not be like this. And you can see that too. It's like we don't really have much control over the pleasantness or unpleasantness of experience as it comes to us. Some are almost inherently unpleasant experiences. Some are pleasant. We can't just filter out the unpleasant and only have the pleasant. It doesn't work that way. It's a 50-50 world. And then there's also a lot of experience that's neutral that we don't really even see. But there's no substantial control over that one way or another. Perceptions, the way that we classify events, the way that we identify objects, identify experience. Similarly, if perceptions were self, they wouldn't lead to affliction. We'd be able to control them, have them be the way we want it to be, but it's a conditioned process based on past experience. We don't really have a self that can control these kinds of perceptions. Mental formations, volitional experiences, the ways that we habitually react in the world, these are also insubstantial, not under a sense of personal control. Of course, consciousness in the end is this, similarly speaking, if it were under a sense of control, of a sense of self, then we'd be able to direct it in any way we wanted to and to have the experiences we wanted to organize our lives in a way we wanted to in our experience. So that's the Buddha's first instructions, is taking his students, his disciples, through that reflection on the essential unsatisfactoriness based on uncontrollability of these five khandhas. They essentially operate according to their own nature. And then he goes through the second approach to kind of dismantling this sense of self around the five khandhas by the reflection on impermanence. If you didn't get it through reflecting on unsatisfactoriness, then go at it through a slightly different tack, looking at the impermanence of these five khandhas. Is form impermanent or impermanent? And the monks will answer, it's impermanent. Is that which is impermanent satisfactory or unsatisfactory? It's unsatisfactory. If something's always changing, if the body's always changing, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, if it's always moving and changing, then there's no sense of solidity that we can hang on to in regards to these elements of experience. And then he asks if they're impermanent, unsatisfactory, of a nature to change, can that be rightfully regarded as, this is who I am, this is myself? And the answer is no, you can't rightfully regard that which is so unsteady and constantly changing and unsatisfactory as who I am, as what I am, this is myself, all the way through consciousness. So it's this kind of picking apart what it is that we think of as ourself, as we were talking about this afternoon. It's this kind of strategy. Not self is a strategy rather than it is a doctrine. It's not a categorical metaphysical statement of there is no self or there is a self. People would ask the Buddha that question. Is there a self or is there no self? And he would say, he wouldn't answer that question. He would just say, trying to answer that question will just lead you into confusion and semantic arguments, but rather use it as a strategic teaching, as a to use a big philosophical word, a teleological teaching, one that has a purpose, one that's used as a reflection to accomplish a purpose of deconstructing this perception or this misperception of self, of who I am. So, and that's in what I just went through was his most fundamental way of using this contemplation as a strategy rather than as a doctrinal statement. So the idea is, the practice is to just keep on doing this over and over again, and essentially as one gets little insights into this and develops more understanding, then in combination with the quieting of the mind, the stilling of the mind through meditation, tranquility meditation, the heart is able to see and experience these insights on a deeper and deeper level, until, as the teachings tell us, it results in this sense of deep insight and realization, to the point where the mind just naturally turns away from seeking its happiness and seeking its satisfaction within these khandhas or aggregates of experience. And one is able to turn to a much deeper, profound level of experience or realization that begins with disenchantment of disenchantment with the five aggregates of experience, dispassion, and letting go of the clinging that we usually have around these five aggregates of experience. And it's that letting go of that clinging, letting go of the upadana, non-clinging to these five aggregates that that brings us to the end of suffering. Because we can still be in the world and be in the realm of experience and knowing these five aggregates, being with these five aggregates, but if there's no clinging involved, if one has seen through the false promises of satisfaction or satisfactoriness that we've been hanging on to with the five khandhas, if one sees through those, then one lets go of that expectation, one lets go of holding on to them and expecting them to provide us with that satisfactoriness. And what opens up to us is what the Buddha calls the experience of the deathless, the experience of non-clinging to any of these aspects of experience at a very deep, profound level. But it's not a quick and easy thing for most people, and we just have to keep using this as a reflection. And I think some people teach and present that you know, we really can't expect to make any kind of headway into this kind of insight unless we've really deepened our practice of calming the mind, of developing deep states of concentration. And I think probably to some extent that's true, but I still find myself that just bringing this contemplation up, even when I'm, you know, not someone who has incredibly deep experiences of tranquility, I still find them extremely useful. You know, providing lots of inspiration about the possibilities of practice and moments of peacefulness as well, moments of letting go and of insight that provide the fuel for me to keep practicing. Even just walking up and down the path back into and from my kuti, and just maintaining that recollection of this body walking through, you know, space. Is this substantial? Is this real? Is it the same experience that I had this morning? You know, just reflecting on the changeability of the body, the sensations in the body, the sensations and moods of the mind. You know, am I feeling the same way I did this morning? How substantial is that? How predictable is that? And just noticing the constant flux and realizing that, you know, it's not a place where I can establish a sense of solidity, a sense of refuge, because I, you know, reflect that, well, this is completely different than it was yesterday or the day before or 5 years ago, and probably in the future, you know, whatever concerns I have now, whatever worries I have now, tomorrow it'll be something different. You know, I might still have some concerns or worries, but it'll be a completely different object. And then just, you know, as I move through the day, I have the opportunity just reflecting on that sense of, well, how could that be anything related to a self? And then just experience experiencing the peacefulness of a moment of not holding on to onto that perception. So one doesn't have to be in deep meditation to bring this contemplation in for benefit. I think it's just very useful to maintain these kinds of contemplations whenever one can, in whatever state of mind, whatever posture, whatever activity one is engaged in. This is one of the contemplations that one can bring into daily life and receive inspiration and benefit from. So I think that's enough for this evening, and we'll leave it there for people to contemplate this evening.